Welcome to the Art of Healthcare podcast, where we aim to be as good at the human side of healthcare as we are at the clinical side of healthcare. My name is Chris Desmond. I'm a physiotherapist who's fascinated by how we can better help the person with the problem. Join us as we learn how to connect better, how to show up better, and how to understand our patients and ourselves better. Welcome to the Art of Healthcare podcast, where we explore the human side of healthcare with experts who help us get better at helping the person with the problem. Today, I'm joined by Zach Gabor. Zach is a practicing physical therapist, co-founder of the Level Up Initiative and now Kalu. And he's really looking to have a massive positive impact on the next generation of practitioners coming through. Zach, welcome to the podcast, mate.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. That was crush the intro.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I've done a few of these now, mate. So I have had a little bit of practice. And now I'm mind blanking. But let's go. First question for you, mate. Why are you interested in the art of healthcare? Why do you care about the human side?
Yeah, I think being out practicing, you don't really sense it in school too much because you're kind of caught up in and wrapped up in the culture of it. But once you actually get practicing and you just start to see the massive influence that healthcare providers have on humans, the good and the bad and the ugly, that really started to shift my perceptions about what really mattered in healthcare. I think you kind of come out graduating as very technically based, very kind of operator. And then you really start to realize that maybe some of these things aren't quite as important as we once thought they were, but perhaps building the meaningful relationships, setting people up for success in the long term, connecting with them, maybe that's where, like, if we could really focus in there, we might be able to really make a big impact. So that's part of my answer.
Yeah, I completely agree with that one as well. And I think for me, those parts are more exciting for me in my practice as well, is that when I'm doing those bits well, I feel much more fulfilled than when I'm just doing the technical stuff well. And yeah, that's not to say the technical stuff is not important. It is very, very important.
For sure.
But it doesn't give me the same kick that I get as kind of looking in someone's eyes and having a deep chat with them.
Absolutely. And I would say one of the other big things that shifted that was just knowing, you know, and Nicole Piamonte, who's a huge mentor of ours, she kind of says, you know, trust is requisite for healing. And when you're able to actually be a human and connect with people, so many things tend to go well in the outcomes. So I think that was another really eye-opening thing for me, was like, oh my God, these outcomes can be incredible with people I'm working with when I actually am bringing my authentic self to clinic, connecting, and really taking the time to listen and learn more about the person in front of me.
I want to loop back around to that trust point and talking about Nicole, because her work is really awesome. But I want to kick things off, Zach, talking about reflective practice to start with and growth as clinicians, because I know that you've done a lot of that. And I think actually a good starting point for that is to start with you from the start and have a little bit of a talk about what was physical therapy school like for you? What sort of beliefs did you hold coming into the physical therapy profession?
Yeah, great question. And yes, many, many existential crises in my short 7 years of practicing. But I would say in school, you know, this was pre-social media era in terms of, you know, all the things we have access to now. So I was kind of in a bubble and I was really wrapped up and seduced into kind of traditional medical culture. So it is, you know, it's like very obsessed with a lot of the anatomy and biomechanics and manual skills and kind of, you know, idolizing a lot of my teachers who were very manual based. And that was just sort of what I envisioned as like the pinnacle of being a great PT. And so that was a lot of my identity, was just this, like, I wanted to tell everyone, including my patients, how much I knew, because that was sort of how I was encultured in schooling. That's what kind of allows you to stand out. And it was just very, very kind of biomedical, because that's, you know, I was trying to do my best, where you're taught to find all, you know, someone comes in with low back pain and it's like, okay, how do I assess their posture and find these different postural deviations? Or how do I look at them move and find some of these different quote unquote movement dysfunctions, you know, or feel for different segments that aren't moving? Like, this is me circa 2014, 2015, during the end of my school and beginning of clinical practice, this was very much the paradigm that I was operating under. So yeah, that's where it all began.
And you came out of physical therapy school, kind of, I'm assuming, fresh-faced, assuming that you're going to change the world with the skill set as well.
Yeah. I mean, like, I definitely have always been a very ambitious person in terms of just like trying to be my best, trying to do the best I can do, trying to be the best clinician I can be. And yeah, very starry-eyed and, you know, equal parts daunting and exciting, because it's actually going into clinical practice under that more biomedical paradigm is actually incredibly nerve-wracking, because someone's coming in and you're kind of putting this pressure on yourself that you need to have this like really good explanation, you know, this really good mechanical explanation of, oh, it's because this isn't moving the right way and that's what's creating your pain and we just need to fix that and then the pain will get better. So I remember feeling like the drip sweats as a new grad kind of practicing in this model. And yeah, just totally oblivious, because I had never really been exposed to really anything that had challenged any of the things that I had learned in school.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And a thought that's just kind of popped up for me is that, like, we set ourselves up with that in a way that is really easy for us to be wrong as well, is that you're wrong if you can't find the specific diagnosis for this person and figure out what's going on with them. And right. Then you're wrong if you have got that specific diagnosis and you've given them the stuff that should make them get better and then they don't get better. So it's no wonder that a lot of the profession is riddled with a whole lot of imposter syndrome when this is the narrative that's going on. But actually, that narrative doesn't stack up against the reality of clinical practice particularly well.
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes it doesn't. You know, sometimes it does, and then you're like, "Ooh, yeah, this is the way I need to go." You know, I need to just keep following the system, and I'll get it. And I think to that point, that's where new grad Zach was very seduced into some of these systems. That was like, I just need certainty in my clinical practice. I need a framework to guide so that I look like I know what I'm doing. And I think that was a feeling I remember really well, was like the angst and anxiety of a new clinician feeling like I was being pulled a million different ways, trying to find this quest for more certainty in my practice and not knowing which way to go in terms of some of these different big, you know, whether it's a McKenzie paradigm or an SFMA paradigm, you know, or even PRI. Like, these were things that were kind of shown in front of me where I'm like, oh man, like, what path do I go? What's the way that's going to give me this sort of certainty? And I just think it's just interesting, because it's like not at all the way that I would go recommend someone to go about thinking about how they're developing as a professional, but that was just sort of the way it was for me and how I was encultured and what I was exposed
to. Yeah. And I think actually frameworks have their place, and frameworks are really valuable thinking tools for us if we can hold them loosely enough, which is really difficult if you're a new graduate clinician, because you don't have the experience and you haven't seen the range of patients that don't fit nicely into that framework as well. But they're often really helpful starting points. And I know that I've found some frameworks ridiculously helpful, especially the ones that have given me scope to work within them with a range of different options. Zach, did you have a reflective practice whilst you were in physical therapy school or kind of coming out as a new graduate?
I mean, not like explicitly, you know, like I've always been somewhat of an introspective person just as like my personality type, but with clinical practice, you know, not really in school, because I think, and again, like, this isn't to knock, because I had a wonderful experience, but, you know, role modeling and my professors, like, there was never really any of that with them in what they were doing in their practice. It was always kind of just like, this is how you do it. No questions asked. Don't ask any questions. Not, and they didn't explicitly say don't ask any questions, but that just wasn't that just wasn't role modeled. Those values weren't role modeled. So why would I kind of take it upon myself? Like, you know, I'm paying tons of money to go to school. Why would I think that anything they were doing should be reflected on or questioned? You know what I mean? It kind of has this bad connotation. So it was never really something that I did in school with specifically to like clinical practice.
And what, as you started to develop, what got you asking questions?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, thankfully to social media. Like, I graduated in 2015, and that's really when things started to kind of take off in the social media world with like physical therapy accounts and great blogs. And, you know, I know there had been like, I had started to get exposed to things that had been around for some time, like the Soma Simple forum. And it was just really mind blowing to me because I was seeing some of these blogs. Like, I remember Derek Miles had a blog about like, you know, stop telling your patients their SI joint is moving or going out of place. And it was like, you know, challenge me to my core. And like Adam Meekins, like the manual therapy sucks debate. And I was like, oh, like, I can't tell you the amount of embitterment I felt and like how it really challenged me to my core. And that was really, it was that in conjunction with kind of like seeing firsthand and really starting to listen to the narratives that patients were telling me. And I was just like, oh shit. I was like, oh my God. I was like, not only are some of these narratives that I'm dropping likely unsubstantiated, but they're also potentially creating some of these, you know, well-intended, but pretty negative side effects in the way of kind of, you know, fear of movement or, you know, or maladaptive beliefs, whatever we want to call them. And that was honestly like, that was the moment that really shifted for me. Like once I had that realization, that was enough motivation for me to be like, well, like that ain't right. Like patients deserve better than that. And that was what sort of catalyzed my, you know, my first real shift into, you know, the next evolution of Zach.
Thank you for sharing that, mate. Curious, do you remember how you felt at the time around that? Like, how did that impact you, like mentally and emotionally? Because that, like that stuff kind of rocks your world a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, the first ego death is the hardest. It's like, you know, I think the simplest way to put it is almost like the five stages of mourning, maybe not necessarily in that order, but certainly, you know, lots of resentment. I remember feeling like so much resentment for my school and my program. Cause I'm like, so much of this stuff has been around for decades. Like how is this my first time hearing about some of the counter arguments or, you know, having some of these things that you look, cause like that's one of the biggest problems is that you're getting new grads that become really, really resentful to their schooling because it wasn't taught with a dose of humility and any of the other reflective aspects. And I think that's problematic because then you create radicalized new grads like me that are like going full shift into like nothing we learn in school matters. It's all shit. And I don't think that's fair. You know, we'll get to like later evolutions of Zach, but like if, like you were saying it before, like if frameworks are held loosely or if they're taken with a grain of salt, they can be really valuable. And what we learn in school, I do think is really valuable if it's taught with that humility and that grain of salt and that counterpoints. And so, yeah, that was like resent is probably, you know, the biggest feeling that I remember. And then just obviously discouraged, just like feeling rocked, you know, my identity as a provider, just a lot of ambivalence around that. You know, I was kind of lost as like, who am I as a provider?
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of that out there and there's a lot of people that do struggle with that. So I'm curious is actually, how did you move past that?
Honestly, man, community and mentors. That was when Clinical Athlete had really just started up. And I was like, oh my God, there's a cohort of people that are like fired up to do better. And in the face of all of this challenging evidence. And so really just connecting with a ton of people through that community, it's like, the saying I think of is misery loves company, where it's like going through ego death sucks. But if you can do it alongside people that are also experiencing that, it makes it a lot more palatable. And so I think just like surrounding myself with good mentors and peers that were like down to have the conversations, I think really made the process. It started to shift the process from something that I perceived as really like negative and stressful to eventually something that became more rewarding and fun and embracing it, which I think is also like a key thing that makes professional growth way more fun when you're able to have that perspective shift.
Yeah, completely. Zach, where was the next big evolution for you?
Yeah, so I think the next big evolution for me was like, I remember it was like the great perception sensation debate of 2017 with John Quintner and et al. In the like pain forum on Facebook and the combination. And I got to speak with Adrian Traeger on a podcast, interview him like when that paper came out that kind of rocked the industry regarding the efficacy of PNE in acute low back pain, where it kind of had showed that it was, you know, no better than sham education. And that really, because I was like huge PNE evangelist, like Adrian Lowe, Laura Mermosley, David Butler, like that was my jam. And I was definitely in this phase of my practice, pain-splaining to everyone, preaching, you know, big into the protectometer. And just that was like my shtick for every patient, you know, no meeting people where they're at, challenging pretty much every single belief that patients had, not touching anyone or doing any manual therapy, you know, just I was really wrapped up in it. And that next evolution was when I really started to come to reconcile like some of just the, I think, reasonable critiques and shortcomings of being too dogmatic or too kind of like radicalized in some of the messaging, because obviously immense value. There's no debating that. But it's similar where it's like, let's slow down here a little bit and start to think about maybe, you know, some of the critiques and shortcomings. And so that was really that next big shift for me, was starting to kind of just learn to be a little bit less certain in my beliefs. And like starting to really grasp, like holding things a little bit more loosely, knowing that things will likely change. Cause that was sort of like, I was at the peak of Mount Stupid when I graduated on like the Dunning-Kruger effect with my biomedical knowledge. And then I got knocked down. And then I was at like an even bigger peak of Mount Stupid with my PNE evangelism, where I was like, no, this is it. This is it. And then it was, you know, another fall to the bottom that really humbled me. But I think that was like, that really solidified that lesson for me of just holding things a little bit more loosely, but at the same time, you know, gleaning the value, like what's the value from the process of learning about that and what's really pragmatic in your practice. So that was definitely the next, the next evolution.
Nice. And I'm starting to kind of see a little bit of a pattern here. I'm looking forward to kind of the next evolutions as well, just to see kind of how that shifts and how it changes. Cause I want to talk to you about it at some point, but maybe not just yet. What did you go through when that hit you in the face? Like, how did you cope with that?
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely better to cope with than the last go of it, because it was a little bit more of a process. I already had great community around me to help with it and some great mentors that were helping. And, you know, it was a little bit easier to cope with and own, you know, and just, you know, it wasn't like just making this declaration where I'm like, I'm no longer doing this. It was just, you know, slowly starting to shift my practice where I wasn't doing as much of the pain spleening, where I was able to meet people where they're at and, you know, enter into these delicate conversations regarding pain beliefs with a little bit more tact and maybe a little bit less of this kind of like scripted talk that I was giving. So yeah, it was definitely that first ego death made this a lot smoother of a transition and shift in my clinical practice.
Yeah. And had you at this stage, like you had the community that you had gathered around you to kind of help you through this process as well, what sort of introspective, reflective practice were you doing at this stage? Do you remember?
I mean, honestly, like I'm sure thoughts in my head, but no real, like, not like I was writing, you know, I wasn't writing in a, down in a dock or anything like that. It was probably more wrestling in my head and then having conversations with colleagues and mentors. And that was probably the biggest mode of reflection for me, was just like having super transparent conversations with those people to help kind of help me make sense of my thoughts and my stances on things.
Yep. And are you someone who finds it helpful to have that processing externally going on?
I think so. Cause it's like, you can get so wrapped up in your own thoughts sometimes that it's hard to make it salient. And I think that having that external communication, it just makes it, it helps me process it a lot better with like, what's really how I'm feeling? What's really my stance on this? And that, I mean, but that requires psychological safety with peers or colleagues that you like really feel like you can be totally vulnerable with your thought process, you know, knowing you're not going to get shamed or whatever for feeling a certain type of way.
Definitely. And I always admire the way, I always envy those people that can do that just within their head. My wife can have a conversation with herself in the head and come out with a fully formed, really coherent argument or opinion or point of view. But I sometimes don't know what it is that I think until I've finished talking to someone about it.
Same. And that's why I love doing podcasts, honestly, because I think in and of itself, it's a reflective practice because you're asking good questions and you have to kind of think about what your current stance is on things. And it's just a good process.
Yeah. And I think that's helpful for people to remember as well, is that like, you don't need to go through this all yourself and try and figure it all out in your head before you start to have this conversation with someone. Like you said, if you have a peer that you feel safe with, or even better, a mentor that you feel safe with, you can go and start to have these conversations and start to process some of this information and process some of your thoughts and hopefully get asked some reasonably probing questions as well to open up further perspectives.
For sure. Totally, man.
So Zach, we're 2017 at the moment. I'm sure there's a couple more evolutions. Where did you go next?
Yeah. So that was sort of when I started to get more exposed to the likes of Mick Thacker and Andy Clark and kind of the predictive processing rabbit holes and just like embodied cognition. So still very fascinated by more of the kind of, you know, bigger picture psychological aspects of care. But this idea of embodied cognition and learning more about it was really, really fascinating to me. And so that was sort of the next year or so, was like really diving heavy as hell into kind of the predictive processing rabbit hole. And then I kind of came out the other side feeling like, yeah, you know, the shortcomings of this as well, where I felt like I was maybe still diving and being like so neurocentric with everything that I was doing. And it wasn't really, you know, the next shift would really be kind of zooming out and starting to understand more about things like phenomenology, the lived experience in that sense, in conjunction with sort of this like bigger picture, you know, what we might call an enactive approach. That was sort of the finale, you know, where I'm currently at, you know, 2018, 2019 on is more of this like super duper zoomed out, you know, enactive approach to thinking about humans, their feelings, how they're interacting in their environments with their bodies, how all of these things are influenced and ultimately the phenomenology or that lived, that experience, you know, that first person lived experience and how that all interplays into these day-to-day interactions. That
as you were going through kind of jumping deeply into the embodied cognition and predictive processing, obviously that was very exciting for you.
Sure.
Did you see the shortcomings or did you see some holes in it as you were working through that? Or was it once you'd kind of got deeply into it?
I want to say yes, but honestly, like I don't. So I will say again, like I think that with each shift, my certainty was like less intense, where I wasn't like, this is the way, you know, but I definitely was very obsessed with it and very like blinders on. That was really what I was focusing on. I would like to think that it was taken with a little bit more of a grain of salt in the bigger picture of my practice. But honestly, I don't think it was till I came up to get air that I realized, oh, okay, like there's some cool things in here, but this is way above my pay grade. And maybe we'll figure out what's pragmatic for clinical practice and reconcile this.
Yeah.
I think it's so hard. Like it's so hard when you're going through something, you feel like, you don't know, like, how could this be wrong? Like what else is there? And it's really not until you come up for air that you can reflect. It's hard to do whilst.
Definitely. And I think as health professionals as well, it's often really challenging for us because our schedules are really, really full. I don't really like the word busy, but we have busy clinical practices. Like we have to serve a lot of people. There's often a lot of other stuff that goes on in our lives as well that doesn't allow the space for taking a pause and having a look at that. Is that something that you've worked in to your practice?
Selfishly, yes, I have, because that's, you know, the free level up mentorship that we do. The whole first 2 months are all reflection prompts, you know, on some of these big picture questions. So I think starting Level Up Initiative, the mentorship in 2018, that was a built-in auditing process for me to just where I was at, reflect on my current thoughts and my current stances. And so I'm really grateful to that because it was just a great way to build that in and help keep me kind of on point.
So do you want to explain a little bit about what the Level Up Initiative is all about and kind of how it came into being?
Yeah, for sure. So this was sort of, try to keep it as brief as possible, but it's hard because it's a little multifaceted, but essentially take the frustration of, you know, evangelist Zach being really bitter about just all the narratives that people are coming in with literally on a daily basis about how broken they are, how they can't get back to doing any things that they want to be loved to doing because of things that they were told by healthcare providers, by social media. And so it was like, you know, I had been spending a lot of time getting into arguments with everyone on social media that I didn't agree with, getting worked up. And it was like, you know, what are you going to do about it? Like, what are you going to do constructive about this besides for just complain? And that was when the idea, I will remember it very vividly. I was driving home back to New York, 3-hour drive in the car by myself, listening to a podcast. I had knew I wanted to do something in the Con Ed realm. I knew that I loved like public speaking and communicating to people and teaching. And the idea hit me where I'm like, oh my God, the Level Up Initiative, it's going to be all about kind of not the soft skills, but in essence, yes, but it was bigger than that. It was like, it's going to be structured around month one being about growth mindset, month two being about critical thinking skills, month three and four being all about communication, you know, listening, communication, humanities. This to me is like the prerequisite that I wish I had before going into clinical practice, because I feel like it would have set me up for so much more success. And so we're going to start this totally free mentorship. And hopefully, you know, if we can get people in it, then they can mentor in a year or two once they've gotten some experience. So we can kind of build this out. You draw it on the board and it looks like a Ponzi scheme, but it was totally free. But ultimately, it was really, I was like, you know, there are these massive accounts that have this huge influence. I'm not going to change their mind, but how could I influence or inoculate as many new clinicians, student clinicians as possible, not with like the way to do it, but just with reflective skills, with a reflective skill set to be able to audit themselves and be okay and embrace kind of constructively questioning things if it means providing best practice. And that was what it was all about. And so we started it in 2018 with 50 people in cohort one. And then it just blew up after that, where I think we had, you know, 200 people in the next cohort, and we've had 7 cohorts total, you know, with the most recent ones, usually with about 400 people in them, and just some amazing mentors, amazing community building, and amazing rallying around this notion of just like commitment to constructively challenging things to provide best practice. And so that's sort of in a nutshell what the Level Up Initiative mentorship was.
Fantastic. And it's evolved since then as well. And like one of the things that maybe the next evolution that you're going through at the moment is trying to reconcile how to kind of keep that going and create it into something larger that also helps put food on your table as alongside still working in clinical practice as well.
Yeah, that's the ultimate challenge, right? It's the healthcare field is just weird, right? Because you get in it to serve people, hopefully. And so it's not even about like me and Steph, my fiance partner, we don't have any aspirations to be like cajillionaires. But, you know, we want to have kids, we want to have basic needs and, you know, clinical pay. It's tough alone. And so it's trying to create this really meaningful community mentorship education platform that's super impactful and is doing real good in the world, but at the same time, sustainable, helping meet, you know, make ends meet and, you know, striking that balance. And so I think we've put in so much front end work and we have created so much high value free stuff that's there now. And so that's great. So like we can continue to keep all that and grow that, but now we can also have paid products and paid mentorships for the right people within our community so that we have, you know, that's sort of the idea is to be able to have things for everyone wherever they're at, you know, whether you're a student, whether you're a clinician that's been practicing for a while, we have amazing free resources and community, but for the right people, we also have paid opportunities to work with us and get mentored and grow. So that's been a fun challenge taking that on.
What are your biggest struggles in that at the moment?
Yeah, I think, you know, imposter syndrome. You know, I had a meltdown this weekend where it's like, I'm telling staff, I'm just so overwhelmed. And it's just like, you know, feeling like just doubting yourself, like, is this even good? This, like, you know, this new product that we built, Kalu Plus, like, is this even good? Is it shit? Like, is it going to work out in the long term? There's so many things we have to do. We have to start getting ready for the free mentorship to roll out. We have to get ready for the summit in the fall. And it's just like, you sometimes it's dealing with those. I think that's just so hard, no matter, like, really any time in life, people are going to go through that. But I find it especially challenging with running a business is just coping with the imposter syndrome. And it's, you know, it's tough. And then it's like, I was so mad because I was like, I was having a full blown meltdown on Saturday with Steph. And then I get a voicemail from a professor at a different program that I've, you know, have a good relationship with. He's like, man, I just listened to your podcast with Nicole. And I just want to let you know, the work you're doing is so meaningful and so impactful and like any way I can help. And I'm just like, God damn it. I'm like, I really wanted to be a miserable son of a bee today. And now it's like, it's messages like that can pull you right out real quick and kind of reframe things. And I think that's as corny as it is when you start with why and you have like true purpose behind what you're doing, that's generally enough to fuel, you know, pulling yourselves out of the depths when you're kind of feeling really down and low on, you know, where things are at.
Zach, thank you for sharing that, mate. I think as health professionals, we're probably a little bit shit at talking about the hard stuff and talking about the feelings that show up in us. Right. I mean, we've been talking about phenomenology and lived experience and an inactive approach, which we're recognizing feelings in other people and what they're going through and their lived experience. But often we fail to see, or maybe we ignore our own lived experience of what this is creating within us as well. And then we have all of these negative feelings and we look around and no one else is talking about them as well. So we think, shit, we're the black sheep here. Like, I've got to struggle in silence with this myself, 100%. Which is actually kind of completely counter to what we tell our patients to do, but leads, I think, to some massive challenges that health professionals face in terms of kind of burnout and leaving professions. And so I want to applaud you in terms of being a voice of talking about this hard stuff and starting to normalize it. So thank you for that, mate.
Yeah, for sure. And it totally is an antidote to burnout, because otherwise you just harbor it and it builds resent, and it's just no good. So yeah, no, I mean, thank you for being who you are, because it's like I said, you need to feel like you're in a good space to be able to share those things. So
yeah, I mean, if we're talking to the people who are listening here, who actually may feel a little bit of this, who may feel, oh, I'm frustrated, I've got a whole lot of uncomfortable feelings going on, I'm feeling like a little bit of an imposter, are there some things that that person could go and do to start to work on that?
Yes. And this is how I tried to ground myself, but my professor friend, he pulled me out of it so fast. I was so annoyed. I just wanted to sulk in it for a little bit. But I think getting the hell off of social media for the day or couple of days that you need, because that just is like trigger city when you're feeling lousy and you look at the highlight reels and you're like, well, this person's in my cohort and they're doing great. And it just creates all this comparison that really is really not beneficial in the long term. So say that's been huge for me, is just like getting that environmental trigger out, because there's just no need. And then I think it comes back to like doing something for someone. So it's like, you often think about when you're feeling this imposter syndrome, it's like, what do I need to do to better myself? Or what do I need to do to fix this or fix that? And it's like, if you can find a way to like do something for someone that you're passionate about, whether that's connecting and helping a friend work through some problems, or helping a younger student or physio working through some things, you know, whatever, just something to that nature, I find can be such a good antidote in the short term to kind of flip the perspective and give you that sense of like, oh yeah, like this is why I do it. This is what it's all about. So I think that's so important. And then lastly, I think the third thing that I try to ground myself with is also realizing that, frankly, everyone is so wrapped up in their own lives that no one really gives a shit about you and like what your perceived projected failures are, how much you think you're sucking, how much you think other people think you suck. Like, no one thinks that. Like, literally everyone is too wrapped up in their own shit. I'm over here having this existential crisis. You think I'm worried about the things you're going through? Like, so I think just reminding myself of that, I think also helps kind of move along and be like, look, I just gotta, you know, just focus on what I'm doing, do meaningful things in my network and my community, and, you know, ride it out, you know, highs and lows. It's a part of life, and just having the persistence to work through it.
Definitely. Thank you for sharing that. And I think like another thing as well is, if you're going out and you're starting to try and have a conversation with someone around this as well, is that sometimes you'll bring this stuff up to a person and they won't actually have the skill set or the capacity to deal with it at that time. They won't be able to hold that space for you and listen and help you process that. And that doesn't mean that what you're going through is wrong. It doesn't mean that no one can help you. It just means that that person at that time wasn't the right person to help you work through that. But the good news is hopefully you know more than one person. So there are going to be some other ones out there that are able to hold that space and help you work through that stuff. So it's kind of, as you said, it's that persistence to keep trying. And like, we all know that there are some health professionals out there who are maybe better in parentheses than others. There are people out there who are better at this stuff as well.
Yeah, for sure, man.
Zach, what does reflective practice look like for you today?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that's, I think, one of my favorite parts about getting to be a mentor for so many newer clinicians and students, is that I am constantly reflecting on my process because I'm putting myself out there on a daily basis with my stance on things or how I might go about things. And getting pushback, you know, not in a bad way, but just getting probed, getting questions like why this, why that. And so I feel very fortunate between Steph, my coworkers locally in my clinic, and then virtually with Kalu and what we're doing with Kalu Plus. It's just a kind of a built-in reflection process, just hashing it out with both of those parties mentioned in that way. I think that's like, you know, everyone kind of figures out their like learning love language, so to speak, or, you know, what their reflective practice looks like. And I think for me, it's verbalizing it, you know, thinking about things internally and then verbalizing it with trusted peers and colleagues, I think is how I go, you know, that for me is the best way to go.
Yeah. And I think like that might be a kind of a nice point to loop back to one of the things that I was noticing with your evolutions as well, is that when you started out, it was all about knowledge and disseminating knowledge in a transactional way. So it was you talking at that person, whereas now your practice has shifted to much more of kind of a transformational focus as well. It's that two-way street of information exchange, which kind of builds understanding on for both parties, both from like your interactions with patients and clients and also your interactions with coworkers and peers as well, to kind of hopefully level up their practice, but also level up yourself as well.
That's a really good point. Yeah. I mean, that's like, that for sure, like highlights one of the key shifts for me as a very early clinician was like, a big mentor of mine, Chris Johnson, was one of the people that when I was like frantic new grad, I'm like, what courses do I take? What systems do I take? And he's like, dude, literally chill out and learn how to listen to your patients and like ask good questions. They'll tell you everything you need to know. And I was like, cool. Like my mind blew and my practice transformed, because it was no longer like, it took a while for me to shift away from like, you know, spewing knowledge, but my ability to really give time to actually listen and try to understand the big picture, I mean, that radically changed my, you know, patient experience and outcomes, I'd like to think, from a more transformational way, because of built like actually starting to build like meaningful relationships.
And if we're talking about trust, and you mentioned that in reference to Nicole Piemonte, who is fantastic. And before you start talking about trust, give a plug for her book as well. I'm about halfway through it and I keep picking it up and then I have to go back and reread it because my sleep addled brain is.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're on sleep debt, that is a tough book to read. But I love Afflicted is such a good book. Nicole Piemonte is a medical humanities PhD. She's doing some really meaningful work just, I think, being a great advocate for a very reasonable and transformative medical culture that she advocates for, that is really grounded in this sort of meditative way of being, where it's a lot more of this two-way street, a lot more of these interactions, and how embracing our own vulnerability as healthcare providers is really, you know, that's almost what sets us up to be these amazing communicators, right? People want to talk about communication skills. And it's, again, like, yes, you can read a book, you can look at some good bullet points, but it's ironically when you can start to be more honest with yourself and be, you know, authentic and vulnerable, that's what builds trust. You know, it's not any one specific skill. It's literally just being more to yourself in clinical practice is what can really lower the guards and set the stage to cultivate authentic relationships and trust.
Yeah. And I think like to be a better communicator with patients, you need to first be a better communicator with yourself.
Amen. Know thyself, man. Yeah. It's so corny, but that like literally couldn't be more true. And that's why in Level Up Mentorship month one, we start with kind of like the Challenge Yourself campaign, or, you know, just what's a time that you really had to look yourself in the mirror and overcome something that you were either like ashamed of or wrong about, or just a challenging time? Because it's like people, you can tell people that are comfortable in their own skin, that like really own who they are. And like, it's just implicitly it communicates trust. You know what I mean? And so it's like, again, it's not any one thing that you do or say, it's just like who you are and the type of person that you carry yourself and that posture you put out into the world, which comes from reflecting on who you even are as a person.
Yeah. Zach, I'm going to ask you, mate, like, we've talked about a lot of stuff today. Off the back of this conversation, what should the person that's listening to this do in their clinical practice tomorrow? Just one thing.
Wow.
If they can take one thing away from this conversation.
Yeah. Jeez, that's so hard. Okay, so I think if I could only pick one thing, because I believe that this would set the stage for the cultivating of all the other things, I think it would really be asking yourself questions, like asking yourself questions about your practice. Like, how did my eval go? Like, did I handle that as well as I could have? What about my plan of care? Why am I doing what I'm doing? I think starting to cultivate some of that self-auditing process will set the stage to reveal other areas that you could really improve. You know, obviously I'd want to say things like listen more and things like that, but I think if you're asking yourself questions, I think you'll get there. But that to me is the critical skill that starts the process of reflection, is asking questions to yourself.
Yeah, I completely agree. And do you have a question to pose to us to maybe go away and reflect on a little bit?
Yeah, I guess, you know, my North Star question for me to like ground me is just like, is what I'm doing like aligned with, you know, truly current best practice? You know, is this patient truly getting the best possible care from me? And what are areas that I could be doing a better job of? And just to give it context, it's like when I was in peak pain science worlds, or PNE world rather, and I was just talking at people all the time, challenging things all the time, like, okay, I thought I was doing best practice because I was integrating pain science, but realistically, I also wasn't doing best practice because I wasn't meeting patients where they're at. I was forcing my worldview on them. Like, that's not best practice. And so I think it's not necessarily just the technical. It's also the big picture clinical skills and asking yourself, like, is what I'm doing truly, truly aligned with best possible practice that I could be doing? And so that would be my question prompt for folks listening.
Thank you, Zach. If people want to connect with you, if they want to check out your stuff, where can they do that?
Yeah, so I think the best two plugs to do that would just be, I think, at the Level Up Initiative is our Instagram, and I operate that mostly. So just reach out, open book, and then you'll see through there we have links for our free Facebook community. I think is just a great place to connect with other like-minded people. And we do journal clubs and case studies, all totally free and just good people. So link for that on our Instagram page as well. But those would probably be the two main ways.
Awesome. Zach, thank you so much for joining me today, mate. It's been a pleasure to have a conversation with you.
Yeah, it's been a blast, man. This is perfect timing because I've been feeling all the feels over the last couple of days. So it's cathartic to be able to have this conversation.
Beautiful. I'm glad I could be a part of it.
Thank you, man.
That's a wrap, team. I really hope you enjoyed that one. If you want to support the show, the best way you can do that is to share this episode out with your friends, your colleagues, your mum, someone who you think might enjoy it, and to make sure that you hit subscribe on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. For more resources for all the episodes, for more information about the Art of Healthcare team, head on over to artofhealthcare.nz and you can find all of that stuff there. The amazing theme music for the episode was produced by my brother Jeremy Desmond, but otherwise you can blame me and my wonderful guest for the rest of the stuff. Thank you guys again so much for tuning in. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for showing the love. I really appreciate you. Have a great week.